I'm be reading through chapter 4, Genesis 25 through 26. It's going to continue into chapter 5, verses 1 through 5. And Adam knew his wife again, and she bore a son, and named him Seth. For God has appointed another seed for me instead of Abel, whom Cain killed. And as for Seth, to him also a son was born, and he named him Enosh. Then men began to call on the name of the Lord. This is the book of the genealogy of Adam. In the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, blessed them, and called them mankind in the day they were created. And Adam lived 130 years, and begot a son in his own likeness, after his image, and named him Seth. After he begot Seth, the days of Adam were 800 years, and he had sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died.
Continuing in our Genesis series, our ninth message from the book of Genesis. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 6. Through which the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded with water. The English Standard Version translates this, the world that then existed. King James, the world that then was. There's a world that existed before our world. The environment was certainly much different. Animal life and the plant life, much more diverse. And these people, being closely related to our first parents, were genetically superior, and they lived extraordinary long lives. As we read in our text this morning, that Adam lived to 930. But like us, they were people who were dead in their trespasses and sins. This first world, is this the Atlantis that Plato wrote about? Is there any evidence for this first world? Well, nothing is really left. Because as we read in Genesis chapter 7, there was a worldwide cataclysmic flood that scraped the surface of the earth clean. Whatever was on top, now on bottom, whatever's on bottom is now on top. Really, this is the only explanation for the massive coal and oil deposits where vegetation, animal life, topsoil, all got trapped under layers and layers of sediment, creating oil. 2 Peter 3:6, the world that then was destroyed, being flooded with water. I think one of the mysteries, and one that's rarely mentioned, is the artifacts that is often found in coal. You can go on the internet and find a lot of information about this. I think I had shown these slides in the past. But this is a real dilemma for secular Darwinists, because coal was supposed to be formed millions of years ago before man ever walked on the earth. And yet, every once in a while, there are these artifacts that show up in coal beds. Well, Peter himself would write that in the last days, mockers will come, and it's going to escape their notice that by the word of God, the heavens existed long ago, and the world at that time was destroyed, being flooded by water. So it escapes people's notice. But as we're thinking about the pre-flood world, how many people were on this first world? From Adam until the flood was 1,656 years. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 1, it said men began to multiply on the face of the ground. Or rather, they actually multiplied and spread out throughout the earth. The population must have been large enough so that God did not have to send a local disaster to wipe out mankind's sin. But it had to be a worldwide flood. kind of gives you an indication of the size of this population of the first world. Now, the ungodly line, Cain, we have recorded up until the seventh generation, Lamech. In the godly line, its genealogy, mentioned in chapter 5, gives us 10 generations up to Noah. The genealogy of Cain is very incomplete. It only brings us up to where Cain's line begins to show real degeneration spiritually, real evil. In fact, it was in the seventh generation of this line that Adam died. And then the line of Cain, after the seventh generation, that's when you start to see real evil start to explode in the world. If we take 10 generations, and let's say each family has 4 children, that would actually be 2 raised to the 10th power, which is only 1,024 individuals at the time of the flood. But this is a period of 1,656 years. Normally, in 100 years, you'll have 3 generations. The 10 generations we have recorded here, from Adam to Noah, actually can include generations in between these major figures. Because from the time that Adam had Seth, it says in the text that Adam had other sons and daughters, which means if he had other sons and daughters, then you can have 2 or 3 generations actually coming about before Seth is even born. And also between all of these others. And so naturally, you think there's about 50 generations possible in this period of time. And really, this can only happen where you have 10 generations, but at the same time, you can also have 50 generations, 50 links and 10 links. You can only have that when you have these individuals living so long through many generations. You're having your great-great-grandson is being born at the same time you're giving birth to your 10th child. You can only have that in the pre-diluvian world situation. Well, how many people can be multiplied over 656 years? Now, remember, the Israelites, they went down into Egypt in the book of Genesis, and how many Israelites went to Egypt? 70, right? And at the end of 400 years as slaves in Egypt, they came out of Egypt with a population of over 2 million. Our world population in the year 1800 was 1 billion. And in 200 years, we're up to 6 billion. So if we were to take the average population growth of our world over the last 200 years and impose that on the pre-flood world, starting with Adam and Eve, in 1656 years, you would have 720 million people. Almost 1 billion people. Now, the flood came in the year 1656. It's been 4,400 years since the flood. Noah's family in 4,400 years went from 8 individuals to 6 billion. In the years before the flood, the population of the earth could be the same population it has taken us 4,000 years to create. You have to calculate a few things in here because, remember, the population is growing, but the older generation is not dying off as quickly. Remember, Adam is living to 930. Seth lives to 912. Noah lives to 950. But after the flood, the ages begin to drop off very quickly. Shem only lives to 600. Shem's son lives to 438. Shem's great-great-grandson, Peleg, lives to 239. Abraham's father lives to 205. Abraham lives to 175. Isaac lives to 180, and Jacob lives to 130. So you see how in the godly line, the ages drop off very, very quickly, the further we get away from Adam. But given the fact that these people lived so long, they had many times a lot of years to produce lots of children. Most of us get past childbearing years by the time we're, what, 40, 45, you know? And, you know, you might want to have 24, 50 kids. I would, but you kind of get too old for that and too worn out. But if you were to live 930, look at all the kids you could have. That'd be great. If you like kids. Some people would think that was a curse, but I think that'd be wonderful. So the older generation is living to the seventh and eighth generation, which is really adding to the population. Adam and Seth were still alive when Methuselah was born. And Noah talked to Methuselah, and Methuselah talked to Adam. So there's very few links there. But, you know, we must also subtract from the population of the flood that we read in Genesis chapter 6, 11, that the earth was corrupt in the sight of the Lord, and it was filled with violence. And so you get this idea that there are warring tribes. One thing that really reduces population is war, famine, disease. Now, I'm speculating on the population of the pre-flood world, not just for curiosity's sake. I would hope that we would get a spiritual lesson here. God destroyed all of these people. God is holy. And people are truly evil. And God is really serious about judging sin and removing the cancer of sin. Yeah, you ever have these Christians who argue about the canopy theory? Oh, was there a canopy of water over the earth and that's how the flood came? Well, that's all interesting and all, but you're missing the point. Millions of souls went into eternity when the flood came. It's kind of like if you're talking about the bomb that was dropped upon Hiroshima and you read about it in the paper and you think, was that a Navy plane or was that an Army plane? You know, no, that's not the point. The point is these lives that went into eternity and the judgment of God. And so we're to read about the pre-diluvian world here. And we don't have a lot of information, but we are to at least develop a healthy fear and respect for God. And that was Peter's point in 2 Peter 2:5. If God did not spare the ancient world, oh, then what does Peter say? Well, if God did not spare the ancient world, then there must have been a canopy, or that's why the dinosaurs had disappeared. No, that's not the point. If God did not spare the ancient world, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the day of judgment, especially those who indulge in the flesh and its corrupt desires and despise authority. Daring self-will, they do not tremble when they revile angelic majesties. The fear of the Lord that the whole account of the flood should put into us. And also Romans chapter 11, verse 22, which is a real good commentary on the flood. Behold the kindness and severity of God. To those who fell, severity, but to you, God's kindness. If you continue in his kindness, otherwise you'll be cut off. You see the grace of God in saving Noah and his family, and yet you see the wrath of God in those who are against him. So which side are you on? Great question to ask. So what we have in Genesis chapter 4 and 5 is a very abbreviated account of 1,656 years of history. Now think about this. Look at all the history that has taken place in the last 1,656 years, from 500 AD to the year 2012. All of the events of Europe, the countries that rose, the countries that fell, the world wars, the 30-year war, the Black Plague, the famines, the institutions that were started, the businesses, the advances in transportation and business. We had the Reformation, the things going on with the Roman Catholic Church, the rise of Islam, the Turks, the Mongols, what happened in China. So all of this history in our 1,656 years, but now we read about the pre-flood world, No history. Nothing's mentioned. And what truth can we glean from this? God has not given these people any attention, is he? Whatever they did, whatever they accomplished has no bearing on God's plan because they weren't his people. God ignores the history of these people because without Christ, without coming to the Lord, their history was in vain. But what little is mentioned is very important spiritual lessons. We see the earthly pursuits of Cain's family, the moral degeneration, the separation between the godly line and the ungodly line, how the ungodly line greatly outnumbers the godly line, how God intervenes with a flood, further limiting mankind's power. So you are amazed over God's protection of his people, and you're amazed over really the mystery of lawlessness in the world that is continuing to work. Satan's kingdom. God restrains it. And you certainly see that in God putting the kibosh upon Satan's kingdom in the flood. Now, the first thing I want us to look at in this text is the separation between these two groups. Two family groups, the godly line and the ungodly line. Again, who quickly becomes the majority? The ungodly line. Why? Do we have any words in the New Testament as from the Sermon on the Mount to tell us why the ungodly line becomes the majority? Enter in at the narrow gate. For wide is the gate. Broad is the way that leads to destruction. Many be there that go that way. Narrow is the gate that leads to life. Few there be that find it. Now, if you notice in chapter 5, just jump ahead there. Every time it mentions a prominent descendant of Adam, it mentions, and Adam had other sons and daughters. Okay? Chapter 5, verse 4, concerning Adam, and he had other sons and daughters. Chapter 5, verse 7, Seth becomes the father of Enosh, and he, Seth, had other sons and daughters. Verse 10, about Enosh, and he had other sons and daughters. Now, there are quite a few commentaries who actually say that these 10 descendants of Noah were the firstborn of each of these families. I don't believe that at all. Because notice it mentions Seth. Was Seth the firstborn? No, he wasn't. We know that at least Cain and Abel were born before Seth. And that Cain probably married one of his sisters, so there's daughters born also at this time. What is being mentioned here are those descendants who actually served the Lord, who represented the godly line. Not necessarily the firstborn, but the one who would carry the godly faith would be Enosh, Methuselah, Noah, Lamech, and these particular individuals. Now, nobody at this time would know which one of the sons of Adam or the sons of Seth would carry on the true belief of God. But remember, Moses is writing this history in retrospect. So he's listing those who carried on the faith all the way down to Noah. But what does this tell us? And this is very sad. Even, you know, think about what I was talking about last week about, you know, how your children turn out. What does this say about all of Adam and Eve's other sons and daughters? The godly line was, people were leaving the godly line and populating the ungodly line quite frequently, where you'd have many sons, but only one son, such as Enoch, would be walking with God. Genesis 4, 16. Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, and he settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. He built a city and called the name of the city Enoch after the name of his son. Cain leaves the presence of the Lord. It's interesting, we get to chapter 4, verse 26. The godly line, they are calling upon the name of the Lord. They have men who are walking with God. The ungodly line leaves the presence of the Lord. What does this mean? Cain probably physically left the area where God was communicating with the first family. And he demonstrated physically his spiritual departure from God. So he settles in the east in a land that's called wandering or wilderness. There he has a son, and he begins to build a city. Now, of course, at first, this city is just simply a walled village with very few houses, but it would soon grow. Cain names his son Enoch. Is it Enoch? I want to make sure of this. Between Enoch and Enosh and various Enoch, yes. And in the Hebrew, this means commencement or a new beginning. And some have speculated that Cain had hopes of reversing the curse that God had put upon him through building this city. And I'm sure Cain was able to build and become prosperous, have many sons, live many years. And I'm sure he probably thought to himself, you know, I've thwarted God's curse. This isn't so bad. Just a lot of people today build their own empires. They're very happy if God would just leave them alone. And it reminds me of, Cain's life reminds me of Psalm 49. Their inner thoughts is that their houses are forever and their dwelling places to all generations. They have called their lands after their own name, just like Cain. But man in his pomp will not endure. He's like the beasts that perish. This is the way of those who are foolish and those after them who approve their works. In other words, this ideology is part of the world. But the real story is, as sheep, they're appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. And their form shall be for the grave to consume, so that they will have no habitation. But God will redeem my soul from the power of the grave. So no matter how much these men thought they accomplished apart from the Lord, there's really no life apart from God, is there? So in the seventh generation, now we read about a descendant of Cain called Lamech. Lamech took for himself two wives. The name of the one was Ada. The name of the other was Zillah. And Ada gave birth to Jabal. He was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. His brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and pipe. As for Zillah, she also gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of all implements of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah, "Listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me and a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. Lamech is the seventh descendant of Cain. Enoch, who is a preacher of righteousness, was the seventh descendant on the other side, in the godly line. We read that in Jude chapter 14, Enoch, the seventh generation from Adam, was a prophet. So this seventh, in the seventh generation of Cain, here you have a bigamist and a murderer. He marries two wives. The law of God for marriage was laid down where? Genesis 2:24. Those two shall become one flesh. But Lamech wanted to do his own thing, follow his own lust. Lamech also murders a man, and he pens the first song in the Bible. This is actually a song, poetry. And it's about his murder. And he boasts that if God would avenge sevenfold anyone who killed Cain, then Lamech would avenge 70 times sevenfold anybody who would kill him. Having murdered somebody. He certainly misunderstood what God was trying to tell Cain. God was not giving people a license to avenge themselves. God was reserving retribution for himself. But it's very interesting that in the gospel, when Peter asks Jesus, you know, how often should I forgive my brother? 7 times? What does Jesus say? Not just 7, but 70 times 7. That's interesting. We read the same thing here, that Lamech wants to avenge himself 70 times 7. So while God's people are forgiving people 70 times sevenfold, the people of Satan are retaliating 70 times 70-fold. So he's glorying in personal revenge. This is the spirit of those who are very far from God. But notice he puts it into a song. Doesn't our art reflect our heart? We sing about the direction and the inclinations of our hearts. I tell you, the violent lyrics in rap and rock and roll are indicative of their hearts. You sing about that which you are interested in. Well, people say, well, they're just reflecting their culture. Well, why follow the culture? Why not sing about love and forgiveness and peace and reconciliation and faithfulness rather than adultery, fornication, rape, murder? Well, that should be a real red flag when you hear people singing lyrics like that. Fallen mankind glories in sin. It's incredible. So Cain becomes a progenitor of this ungodly line, which is also something that we can talk about, because Exodus chapter 20, God says, I will visit the iniquity of the fathers on the children unto the third and fourth generations of those who hate me. Now, you've got to understand this text. God is not saying I'm going to punish the children for the father's sin, nor does this text is not saying I'm going to make the children sin. The word here is to visit. It doesn't have the idea of punishing. It doesn't have the idea of compulsion. But it means to abide upon or to come upon. Now, the text doesn't really say how the sins are visited, but we know that in practical life, children learn from the example of their parents. And I think that's the way this visitation has taken place. We can affect our descendants for good or evil. Remember years ago, there was this famous study about the descendants of two families. One was Jonathan Edwards, the famous preacher in New England. And they studied his descendants and then the descendants of a fellow by the name of Max Jukes, who was a kind of a seedy fellow who lived out in the wilderness in New York State. Well, out of Max Jukes' descendants, a quarter were poor, quarter died in infancy, 50 women were prostitutes, 400 men were drunkards, 7 murderers, 60 thieves, 130 of his descendants were convicted of other crimes. Jonathan Edwards, who lived at the exact same time, had 1,394 descendants, 13 became college presidents, 65 college professors, 3 United States senators, 30 judges, 100 lawyers, 60 physicians, 75 Army and Navy officers, 100 preachers and missionaries, 60 authors of prominence, a vice president of the United States, 80 became public officials in other capacities, 295 college graduates. And Jonathan Edwards' descendants didn't cost the state a single penny. You say, well, that's because Jonathan Edwards was rich. No, Jonathan Edwards was very poor. Remember, he ended his life working in poverty in a small Indian village up in Massachusetts. He was not a landowner, he was not a politician, he wasn't really famous at that time, but he was a godly man. You see the difference it makes between, you know, where you direct your children. So Cain is a progenitor of an ungodly race. But here's another issue, and this is always fascinated me about this particular text. You've got Jubal, who is the father of ranching. These are the sons of Lamech. Jabal, father of ranching, Jubal, the father of musical instruments, and Tubal-Cain, the father of metalworking. Now, when it says that these men were the father, it means that they were the founders, kind of like Freud's the father of modern psychology, or Louis Pasteur is the father of modern medicine. These are the, they got these industries going. But isn't this interesting? Here, Lamech is a bigamist and a murderer, and he has gifted sons who become leaders in industry. The prosperity of the wicked. Now, when we read about the godly line in chapter 5, we don't read about any of this industry, but they are calling upon the name of the Lord. It's not that the godly line is against music or against metalwork or farming. Godly line just has different priorities. Leupold, who is a Lutheran commentator, has a good comment about this reality, which this paragraph, I've always loved it. For he says this, "For strange to say, civilization did make far greater strides among those alienated from God than those who were devoted to God. Yet this is not strange, if closely considered. For they," the ungodly line, "being addicted and devoted to the things of this world, and not satisfied with this world's treasures, for who can be, they, we say, do all in their power to make an empty existence attractive by cultivating natural resources of the world. Besides, the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light." And who said this last statement, by the way? It's in the Gospels. Jesus said that. That's always been really helpful to me because I've always had guilt, a guilt complex over industry, invention, and productivity. I don't know if you're like me, but I was raised in a home where if you're not doing industry, you're a failure. And that really needs to be tempered with some other biblical truths. We must realize that because we're pursuing God, we may not accomplish the great industry and achievements that the world praises. Christians may not win Olympic medals. We tend to put our efforts into the Great Commission. Even though there may be a few Christian athletes, in fact, I was reading this week about Gabby Douglas and her testimony. She goes to a church in Des Moines, and she's a believer. She has a solid testimony, which is good. But we also have to remember 1 Corinthians chapter 1. You see your calling, brethren, that there are not many wise, not many noble, not many mighty are chosen. God has chosen the foolish things of this world. You know, how many PhDs do we have here this morning? Okay, you know, God has chosen those of us who really are not as talented, maybe. But one thing we got to remember is don't judge the faith of Christ by worldly talent or success we can have in this world. I think, the ladies, when you used the ladies' Bible study? Not this Monday, but the next? Remember Samson? He was all impressed with the Philistines because they were the modern society, and he would run down there, and he's impressed with their women and their technology, and I think people judge it this way, that the people with the most success and the most wealth are the people who have the truth. Is that true? You will find that the people who are ungodly often have the bigger cars, the bigger houses, and they may actually accomplish more in industry, sports, and entertainment. They may actually make better movies than the Christians make. You ever watch a Christian movie, and as soon as you start watching a Christian movie, I know this is not going to be a good movie. You know, the acting is going to be lousy. You know, the lines are going to be really trite. But then you watch a movie of the world, and it's like, wow, look at the special effects. Look at the... And you think, well, what's with the Christians? The gospel's still true regardless, Remember, we're a small minority. We don't even have the population to actually produce this stuff. And, you know, Christian leaders need to be very careful about promoting Christian individuals every time somebody in our number wins some sort of prize or becomes a leader in industry. Because I think that conveys the wrong message to the church. Because we don't base truth and success for Christ whether one of our numbers happens to become a Hollywood movie star. Certainly does convey a wrong message to the sheep. So I want to encourage our young people this morning to be technically excellent. Develop your talents. Christians are not lazy, undisciplined people. But don't live to build your kingdom here on earth like the descendants of Cain. Have the right priorities. So we got here the ending of this particular text, and you say, oh, wow, the ungodly line of Cain, Lamech, he was a bigamist and a murderer. If that's all we had in our society today, we'd be a saintly country, right? You see what's going on in, you know, these shootings at the Sikh temple and also, you know, in the movie theater. And so the guy's a bigamist and he murders one person. That seems like nothing today. But remember, what the Bible here has mentioned is the first beginning of depravity. By the time we get to Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, every intent of the thoughts of these people's hearts would be only evil continually, and the earth would be completely filled with violence. Lamech in the seventh generation, which could have been just 300 or 400 years after Adam and Eve, they're just getting started. So let's sum up the line of Cain real quickly here. All right. These are foundational principles because the ideology of the line of Cain is continued throughout all time. And there are foundational principles. First, Cain, the whole society is founded on the concept of man's self-sufficiency. We're going to go out from the presence of the Lord and we're going to do this without God. That's the world. The world's still doing that today. They're antagonistic toward God, his ways, his judgment, his words, and his people. There is this antagonism. They are separated from God, though sustained by God. They want to be separated from God, but they still want God to give them the oxygen to breathe, water to drink, food. They don't realize how much they're being sustained by God, even though they want to live apart from him. And they are stubbornly persistent in futile efforts to remove the curse of sin and establish a life of stability and security. All right, we ought to try to live a life of stability and security for Jesus Christ, but not the way the world does it. They want to build their castles in the sand down here on earth. Now, this list, I didn't come up with that. That's from my Old Testament professor back in college. I just need to give credit where credit's due. And I've always loved that analysis of the life of Cain. Now, we're going a little long here, but I'm going to try and wrap it up. The godly line, what we see with them is a simplicity of life devoted to God, and they're small in numbers. Seth is described as being made in the likeness or image of Adam, and I think that's a spiritual likeness. The godly line, they are the true humanity. Seth means substitute. Abel was taken home to be with the Lord in heaven, but God gave Adam and Eve a descendant to carry on the faith. Seth gives birth to Enosh, and that means frail. Then men begin to call upon the name of the Lord. Which men? All men? Well, we're now in the section that's talking about the godly line. It's really talking about the godly line begin to call upon the name of the Lord. And some have seen in this statement that this is the beginning of prayer. You know, we take prayer for granted, don't we? But this time, maybe these people were kind of wondering, you know, does God even want to hear from us? Does God really need to hear from us? Is it even right for us to ask something from God? So we take it for granted, but then they might have thought, well, maybe God doesn't want us to talk to him. But now they're starting to realize they need to call upon the name of the Lord. And now those who have an affinity for God are seeing that the days are becoming very dark. This son, Enosh, is born. They see the frailty of humanity, and they name him frail. And they begin to pray. Isn't it true that we only begin to pray when we get ourselves into trouble? You all know that, right? You never pray like when you're having difficulties. But this is not just talking about prayer. A lot of good commentators say that this is the beginning of corporate worship, group prayer. And for the first time, the people of God are now gathering together as a church. Within three generations of Adam, they're now practicing regular worship of the Lord. Chapter 5, you get a recap of the Adam's genealogy. And then you have Enoch born, and he is a preacher of righteousness. It says he walks with God. Does that mean God actually appeared to him and he walked? Well, it also says Noah walked with God, and God told Abraham, walk with me and be perfect. So it's talking about spiritually walking with God and talking with God. And then we read in Jude that Enoch was a preacher who preached that someday that the Lord is going to return with 10,000s of his angels. So here Enoch is preaching about the rapture of the church in the pre-flood world. But what happens to Enoch? He himself gets raptured off the earth, and he is taken to be with the Lord before he dies. And so his life becomes really an example of the future rapture of the church, where one will be left and one will be left behind. Another thought about Enoch is very interesting. When his son Methuselah was born, it says, then he began to walk with God, implying that from age 65 earlier, he wasn't necessarily walking with God. You know, even the godly line, they all had to make a decision in their life. I'm going to be the man who walks with God. You need to make that decision, whether you're 30 years old or 40 years old, 65, you have to make the decision, even as Enoch did. And of course, now Noah's born. And well, let's talk about Methuselah a little bit. Methuselah, it's interesting that his name means that when he dies, it will happen. What will happen? The flood. All right? But the point is that the godly line were very in tune with the voice of God, and they knew the mind of God, and they all were prophets. God communicates to his people so that what they do becomes very prophetic, and they have this insight that the world doesn't get. Now, Methuselah, it says about him that in his day, when he dies, it will come. That's what his name means. I'm extrapolating it out a little bit there, but who's the one who lived the longest in the scriptures? Methuselah. What is it? 965? Interesting. A lot of Bible students have said, listen, all right, look, the longest man who ever lived is also the man whose death was going to prophesy the destruction of the world. So you see the patience of God in the life of Methuselah. He is the guy who lived the longest because he demonstrates the patience of God, who was waiting in the days of Noah, as we read in 1 Peter chapter 3. Noah means rest. He will give us rest. Conclusion. Imagine if you could enter into a time machine. Take you back to the year 1648 after the creation of the world, 10 years before the flood. Wouldn't that be great? You could speak to Methuselah, and you could speak to Noah, and you could learn about all the drama going on at that time. I mean, I'm sure there's some things you could share with Noah that would be encouragement to him. And then there's some things that Noah could share with you that would be an encouragement to you. And you would walk among these people who are going about their business completely unaware of the shortness of their time. You'd be at the cusp of the end of their world. That would be a really interesting journey. Now, I say this so that you don't take for granted the day in which we live, because we are living in the final days of our age. And there is a much more glorious event that's about to take place than the flood, the second coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. We are on the brink of the end also. And remember, for the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah, for as in those days before the flood, they were eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day Noah entered the ark. They did not understand until the flood came and took them all away. So will the coming of the Son of Man be. There will be two in the field, one left. One taken, one left behind. See, that's the great application of this text. We are in the same kind of drama, the same kind of environment that Noah was in. Even a greater drama, a greater conflict. And we need to spiritually perceive the days in which we live and act accordingly, to not be so obtuse spiritually. Knowing the time, that now it's high time to wake out of our sleep, for now is our salvation nearer than when we believed. The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Let us therefore cast off the works of darkness and let us put on the armor of light. That's what the story of the pre-Diluvian world is all about.